Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Ella Mapes. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from Scarborough Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, we have an interview Tony recorded last July with Nick Korkos from Bristol Archaeology, who explains the role archaeologists have to play in new building developments. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or you would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
I'm joined by Nick Korkos, who's an archaeologist based in Bristol. Now, who do you work for, Nick?
I work for a little company called Avon Archaeology Limited.
Well, it sounds big. Avon's quite a big zone, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, we cover the Bristol area, North Somerset, South Gloucestershire, Baines. We sometimes go into Somerset. But we are a small company. Now, there's only seven of us.
The thing is, there's actually quite a lot of development going on. This is new buildings where someone's bought a piece of land, they flattened it, then they want to build something new on top of it. I mean, I'm thinking particularly about Temple Way. A lot of that has been flattened over the last 10 years. And it sounds seven people doesn't sound very many to do all the archaeology for all that area, considering we're living in a bit of a developer boom at the moment.
Well, like all big cities, you're right, Bristol is, I mean, cities are constantly being rebuilt though, Tony. I mean, it's a constant rolling programme of building. But yes, we are only seven and therefore we pace ourselves. We don't do those massive infrastructure jobs or the massive jobs. We take the jobs that we can handle.
Now, archaeology back in the 1960s and 70s and before was a bit of a hit and miss thing. And now it's not, because whenever a planning application is put in, a developer, a speculator or whatever wants to build something, they have to come to you guys at some point, don't they? And how do they how does it all work? So I understand, that's how I understand, but you can clear it up.
Yeah, the overwhelming majority of professional archaeologists in the UK, I don't know the number, but it must be something over 90%, are employed because of the planning system. And before 1990, it was basically the Wild West. So sometimes developers might bung some archaeologists some money to do a little bit of work before they put up yet another horrendous tower block. Or there might be rescue archaeology, which is basically where people learned that there was to be a development and they got in there and they did the archaeology as quickly as they could, rescued what they could, hence the term rescue archaeology.
Well, that isn't necessarily going to be easy if you don't own the land. Someone else has fenced it off. And also, they might not want you to find anything.
Yeah, precisely. But bear in mind, I'm talking about prior to 1990 now. So that is absolutely right. And the corollary of that is that shed loads of stuff got destroyed. Loads of stuff got destroyed. In the late 1980s, there was a plan to put up a massive tower block. I think it was an office in London. Now, it was known that it was likely to be on the site of the Rose Theatre, associated with William Shakespeare. And in fact, there were archaeologists on the site, and they discovered the foundations of what they said was the Rose Theatre, and they were proved correct. Now, what was going to happen was that those remains were going to be destroyed in the course of the development of that building.
Okay, so the idea is these guys want to build a tower block. We need foundations. We just need to get rid of this stuff.
Exactly.
We'll give you 5 minutes to have a little dig around.
Exactly,
but, you know,
right.
Get out of
basic,
the way.
Basic recording, then off. We don't want you anymore. And bear in mind, there was nothing illegal about that. This was before there was any kind of planning guidance.
So if you bought the land, you actually bought the history of the land as well, and you could bar any archaeologist from going in there.
Absolutely. This is why I say shed loads of stuff got destroyed. Now, when news of this got out, as inevitably it did, what happened next was actually quite remarkable. You had all these famous people coming out of the woodwork, the likes of Ian McKellen, Derek Jacobi, Judy Dench. You had a parade of these famous loveys going on camera and basically saying, this is outrageous, this is scandalous. William Shakespeare was associated with this building. How dare you do this? And to cut a very long story short, in 1990, the Tory government introduced a key piece of planning guidance called PPG 16, Planning and Policy Guidance 16, which is a gripping bedtime read. But the principle that it established, Tony, was absolutely fundamental.
So how did it change archaeology? Because what we're saying here is that if there is any kind of thought of there being something underneath that's worth saving, that a developer has to pause everything and let archaeologists get in there first.
It's not quite that simple. The thing is, there are levels of archaeological intervention. But what PPG 16 fundamentally established was the principle that if you are developing a site, then archaeology is a material consideration, just like everything else, just like, for example, ecology had become. So you've got your great crested newts or whatever it might be. Prior to that, archaeology had not been a material consideration.
So what was archaeologists' role before that? 'Cause I imagine that, you know, you were having to sort of beg and scrape to these powerful people and say, look, please, can we have a quick look before you build a building?
Yeah, that's effectively how it worked. Again, that's a bit simplistic, but that is effectively how it worked. A lot of archaeologists were employed in academia. And in fact, even now, most of what I would call pure research in archaeology is done by the universities. 90% of archaeologists are employed because of the planning system. And that principle of developer having to fund archaeology has gone up to the present day. Although the guidance has gone through several different versions, it's been a key aspect
so,
of planning guidance.
Yeah, the thing is, though, I mean, if I was a big developer, I just want to get my tower block built, I'd be thinking, well, I'm going to employ those archaeological businesses or companies or consultancies that don't find anything. That go in there, they spend 2 or 3 days, they dig around and they always come back and say, oh, well, there's nothing to see here, Gov.
There has been a suggestion that consultancy represents the dark side. I couldn't possibly comment on that. To be honest, that goes above my pay grade. What normally happens is that a planning application goes in and it is then up to the local authority to decide the level of archaeological intervention. Because local authorities, as we have in Bristol, they employ their own archaeologists. And it's down to that person to put a condition on the planning consent.
Well, look, Nick, what happens when you find more than you expected? Have you ever been yourself put under time pressure and told, well, hang on, you've got to get all your archaeology finished within the next 3 or 4 days because the foundations and the concrete are coming in?
We are very often under time pressure. But I'll tell you what, Tony, if push comes to shove, it goes above our pay grade. If I'm on a site and I've got the developer screaming in my ear, and then I'm in front of a machine, and the machine puts its bucket into the ground and turns up a Roman mosaic pavement, everything stops. Everything stops. And I'm onto the phone to the local authority archaeologist, because that's not my call. That's his call or her call. That goes way above my pay grade.
Has that sort of thing ever happened? Have you ever found Have you ever found anything like that? Roman mosaic's a bit of a big ask.
Not to me. Oh, well, that does happen. Not to me. And that also, there's only the pressure when we're doing what's called a watching brief. Now, a watching brief is basically when it's literally what it says on the tin. You are on the site as it's being developed, and you are watching the machines pull the stuff back, and you are recording as best you can. That's the lowest level of archaeological intervention. And then they grade upwards from there.
But on some sites, you get the chance to go in beforehand, don't you, and have a good
Absolutely.
Old dig around.
Yeah.
I mean, how much time does that generally take? I mean, obviously, it depends on the site.
Yeah, it's how long is a piece of string. For example, at the moment, we are up at a site in Fayland, And we're doing the next level up from a watching reef, which is called an evaluation, where basically you dig a series of trial trenches. So we've got 10 trenches, 50 metres long each. That's actually quite a long trench. And we're on our own.
How do you dig that? You have to physically dig it yourself?
Or it's dug by machine.
Well, isn't that itself? You could be destroying stuff by using a machine, couldn't you? No.
No. Well, obviously, we try not to. We'd be pretty mortified. But the whole point is, for a start, I mean, do you realise how much material you'd have to shift in a trench that's 2 metres wide and 50 metres long?
Okay, there quite is a no, lot, yeah.
Yeah, there is no way you could do it by hand. So it is controlled machine excavation. So basically, you have an archaeologist standing with the machine, and the machine goes down and down and down in strips until you either hit natural ground or you see something possibly interesting. You then stop. Then you go in by hand. So it is completely controlled.
What about generally underground in Bristol? What is under there? Because I think, you know, we walk along the city streets to and from work every day, but in most big medieval cities like Bristol, there's bound to be some stuff under there. I mean, all I really know about myself is medieval conduits, which brought in water from, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. In fact, in Exeter, if anyone's ever in Exeter, you can go down and actually walk through them. Yeah, I mean, generally, what would you expect to find underneath a medieval city?
Again, I'm afraid it's a how long is a piece of string question, because it depends entirely on the subsequent history of the city. But in general terms, and I think this might not possibly be realised, in general terms, our street levels are metres higher than they were originally. So, for example, if you go to Bath, the Roman street level is several metres below the modern street
level.
So
why is that? People just built up?
That's it. Well, what happens?
Wanting cellars and more floors
Something? Absolutely. When a building is demolished or falls down, very often, you know, why bother to cart the stuff away? You just spread the rubble around. And also people dump stuff. And over centuries, especially in a city, the levels just build up and build up and build up.
Well, I suppose that's quite good for you guys, because it means under there, if you dig down far enough, you'll find preserved things from hundreds, even thousands of years ago.
That's absolutely right. Except, of course, as you've mentioned yourself, where our wonderful Georgian and Victorian forebears did have a tendency to dig socking great cellars. And a cellar will just trash everything in its path. So where you've got a cellar, basically, I mean, it's a bit simplistic, but by and large, it will have destroyed a lot of archaeology.
What about things like wells? Because I imagine before there was a proper water supply, this is one of the real characteristics from even pre-medieval times, but certainly medieval times. Yeah. People need to get their water from somewhere before Bristol Water came along and charged their extortionate prices.
Okay, I didn't say that. You said that. So if you're going to get sued by Bristol Water, okay.
Well, actually, no. I mean, it's on the record that Bristol Water are the most litigious, and they've come up the most criticism of any other water company by the regulators Ofwat. But anyway, that aside, how about wells? Do they tell you quite a lot about what's been going on in the past?
Indeed. In fact, the site about which you first contacted me, Dean Street, where there is a block of student housing going up, where we did a watching brief, okay? So that's the lowest level of intervention. We were there while they were machining away, and we recorded as best we could. We had no fewer than 3 wells on that site, and one of them was a monster. I mean, it was absolutely massive. In fact, but by and large, what happens is there's no point in, for the developers, there's no point in trying to grub it out or stuff. What they will normally do is just backfill it. They'll fill it with rubble. So, in fact, it's still there. And that's what they did, as far as I'm aware, with all 3 of the wells.
I mean, was this water have been of reasonable quality? One does wonder.
I have absolutely no idea. I have absolutely no idea.
I suppose now, the thing is that St. Paul's and that area around Portland Square is actually, you know, maybe if we go back even just a few hundred years, it's probably rural almost.
It was. The early maps, if you look at the early maps, which are all, I should say, make a really important point, Bristol has a really great system of online heritage called Know Your Place. Are you aware of that? That's one for your listeners. Fantastic resource. All the early maps and freely available online, and all the other local authorities have got it as well. Okay, it's a joint venture between the West Country local authorities. And if you go onto that and you look at that area of St Paul's, yes, there's a map of about 1740, middle
See,
of the
See, that's 80. Lovely, isn't it? If you could just find your place now and then wind the maps back as far as they'll go.
That's precisely what Know Your Place allows you to do. It is a fabulous resource. I wonder how we survived without it in our work, to be honest. It's only been in for a few years, but that's exactly what you can do. You can literally pull across and you can see earlier maps. And that area was kind of gardens and paddocks and some orchards and that kind of stuff. So, but bear in mind, of course, that these early maps won't necessarily record stuff that was there but had gone before the map was made. It won't record if there's a Roman villa there that had disappeared, you know. So just because something is not shown on a map doesn't mean to say there's nothing there.
Sounds like a silly question, but it isn't. How deep do you dig? Because, I mean, it may be that you have a little scrape around, you don't find anything, but actually there could be something deeper down. So how deep do you actually go?
Again, it's how long is a piece of string, because it's entirely controlled by the conditions. We usually stop when we hit either natural ground or archaeology. In other words, structures or features, and then we stop.
So what do you do? Do you poke down with a stick?
No, again, it's very often using a machine under controlled conditions. Okay, and what we would then
do... So a little digger, basically.
Yeah, little digger, big digger.
Okay.
Again, entirely depending on conditions. Even when you get archaeology, it's considered good practice if conditions allow and if it's a requirement of the brief to go underneath it just to make sure that you've seen everything. Because you're absolutely right. The whole point is what we call stratigraphy. You get layers of deposition. So you can get prehistoric, then you get Roman, then you get early medieval, and so on and so on.
Are there any sites that you've looked at that particularly stick in your mind as being either coming up with surprises or finding interesting, something interesting under there?
The great thing about archaeology, Tony, is, oh God, this is going to sound so specious, and I apologise in advance. Every site is different. Some sites, to be absolutely candid with you, are not grippers. They're what we would call bread and butter. We did a site recently out at Emerson's Green where there'd been a prior geophysical survey and we'd expected to find quite a lot. We did find two socking great ditches that had been cut into the bedrock with kind of metal tools, we presume. But somebody went to a great deal of trouble before the time of modern machinery. That must have been an enormous amount of work, but no finds at all. So virtually everything at that site is undated.
I mean, this area, for example, this part of the country, was quite a lot of mining going on, wasn't there?
There was a lot of mining going on, and what tends to be forgotten now is that, of course, we're on the northern part of the Somerset coalfield. So Bristol, surprising as it may seem, Bristol has a pretty long history of coal mining, especially in the Kingswood area.
Now, I can remember living in Bedminster out of the back of my yard one day to find a hole had appeared in the...
Really?
In the alleyway out the back.
Right.
And that we reported it and someone came and put a big fence around it or whatever. But, I mean, that was... I'm not sure, but the people that came from the local authority said, oh, well, we believe it's actually mine shafts here.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. And but, as I say, Kingswood is the main area. Interesting place, Bedminster, incidentally, for a whole variety of reasons. It was in Somerset, and like most large cities, Bristol is really a collection of villages. So what's happened is, over centuries, it's expanded out from a core. I mean, London is the classic example, but it's a collection of villages, of which Bedminster was one. Bedminster is an extremely ancient place. It was a royal manor before the Norman Conquest, massive, massive estate. And it's, as the name suggests, it's a minster church. It's basically, the church is an extremely ancient foundation, we think probably 7th century. Yeah, it's a really interesting place. We've done quite a bit of work there. And also there's shed loads of Roman stuff in Bedminster.
So the original Bedminster was in the park between Church Lane and St. John's Road.
Yeah, I think it's a piece of open green space now.
Possibly bombed in the war, but anyway, it's been demolished. But it's interesting to know, isn't it, that actually that's where the Minster comes from. I mean, there's actually quite a lot, isn't there, in place names that gives you clues as to what's going on.
Don't get me started on place names. We'll be here all night. One of the remarkable things about place names is the amount of nonsense that's talked about place names. There's a guy called Paul Reaney, Dr. Paul Reaney, who was an academic specialist in the study of place names ages ago, and he actually opened one of his books on the subject by saying something like, more nonsense has been written on the subject of English place names than on any other historical study. And it's true, and you have to know what you're looking at. And it remains true to this day. There's a book published a good few years ago now on Somerset place names. I won't name the author because I certainly don't want to end up in court. And it was just nonsense from start to finish.
So maybe this is just sort of gossip picked up in the pub.
I don't know, Tony. I'm a bit more cynical than that. I mean, I think that some of these books are published just to make a fast buck. Because the thing about place name is it's a very, very highly specialist study. The study of place names is the study of language and the way that language changes through time. Therefore, place name specialists are linguists, and they're linguists in languages like Old English, Latin, the Scandinavian tongues. And that can get a little bit obscure. And it's always struck me that it's just a way to make a fast buck.
So, I mean, one of the main things about a place name is which era it comes from. Say it might have a bit of French in it, so that's probably going to be Norman. Any way to sort of start in figuring out, you know, a particular place name, whereabouts it's originated?
I would say you need a good book, to be honest. And we're very, very lucky in Bristol because we've got a book by a guy called Richard Coates, only published 3 or 4 years ago by the English Place Name Society. And the English Place Name Society is the leading voluntary body for English place names, specialists and academics and experienced researchers, and eminently authoritative. And it's worth a tenner of anybody's money. I mean, it's a great, great book.
Let's just pick it up and flick through some of the, just to give an idea of some of the famous Bristol places. Like, for example, Christmas Steps. It says a steep thoroughfare leading to the residue of medieval Christmas Street. There's a long history of England of names which have become obscure, which are then represented in the light of less obscure words and names, especially of religious significance. Hugh Smith drew attention to Knifesmith Street, said to him to be lost. This has become Christmas Street. Surely a simple alteration by folk etymology or rationalisation of the lost name, Knifesmith, Cutler, in its late medieval pronunciation would have been... Well, I mean, I can't pronounce that. No. The audible and first vowel is in T, not as in tie, then probably shortened before a cluster of three consonants of the vowel sounding tip. This is no means far from Christmas. So it's possibly that this is where it actually originates in Knifesmith from the 1580s and Christmas Street from the 1480s, the periods of the relevant changes. So fascinating little insight there into what that could have been.
Waiting round every corner, when collide. you're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Chipping Sodbury, for example, from Old English burg fort in the dative case form Birig, preceded by the male given name Sopper in the genitive case, with a noun recorded as Soppenbrig, about 900 BC. Is that AD? CE? What's that?
It ought to be AD. 900 AD, I would have thought.
Yeah, around 900 AD. The fort is the impressive Roman period hill fort on top of the Cotswold escarpment above Old Sodbury village. Actually, you can see that on the road to Stroud on the left-hand side as you're driving along. But, I mean, this has got a little bit of insight into almost everywhere around the Bristol area. And it's not just Bristol. It's quite a lot about Gloucestershire in there.
But street names are really great. And the thing about street names especially is that they get down to a really intimate level of landscape, but also the mindset of our forebears.
Now, I know you've had a good old look at Wade Street in St Jude's, haven't you?
Yeah, that isn't the one I was going to mention.
Okay, we'll mention the other one, and then we'll get on to Wade Street.
Yeah, it takes us right into the mindsets of our medieval predecessors and casts a light back on our Victorian sensibilities. Some of these names were really very, very earthy. And one of the common ones is Grope Lane. And Grope Lane, it's kind of does what it says on the tin. It was the medieval name for what is now Nelson Street in Bristol. And it's generally assumed that names of this type were associated with prostitution. And in fact, there is one example from a guy called William of Worcester who was writing in the late 15th century where he even elaborates on that. So we know that part of the name was Grope Lane, but he adds another word, which I'm not going to mention, except off mic. But it really shows that the sort of earthiness of our medieval forebears. But when you think about, you know, Chaucer's Wife of Bath and this kind of thing, is that so much of a surprise? The thing is that these names are as much a part of our history as any archaeological artifact. Now, in London, several of these names survived and they were got rid of. Deliberately, as a deliberate policy, as it was thought to offend sensibilities. And I just think that's wrong. I think that's outrageous.
What about Wade Street, then?
Wade Street, we did a site at Wade Street. It was one of the first large ones we ever did in 2014. That was a full excavation. So that basically is the highest level of archaeological intervention where you strip the entire site. And you're given weeks or months in which to do it. It's also the most expensive option for the client. So if they're hit with a full excavation, it sometimes can go down like a lead balloon. But the truth of the matter is, Tony, that in the case of a large development, the proportion that goes to archaeology, if you think a large development can cost millions but also earn millions of pounds in the final development, it's peanuts. It's complete peanuts. But we did a job there. It was an early 18th century development. The Wade Street is named after this guy, Nathaniel Wade.
Wade Street is roughly between the massive Cabot Circus car park, and it runs up along past the side of that up to around about St. Nick's Tolentino Church. What did you find there?
Well, we kind of knew what we were going to find because it's on the maps. It's an early 18th century development of terraces and little alleyways and courts. And again, if somebody goes on to know your place, you can see all of this stuff. And we had the remains of buildings. We had surfaces. We had some really nice cobbled surfaces. We had cellars. It's kind of bread and butter type of archaeology, but it was really interesting. It was really interesting to work for that length of time within that community. And the nice thing about that particular piece of work is that our final report is available online.
So is your most of your material available? You know, if people want to look at your reports, can they see them, or do they fade away when the planning application goes?
You see, this is, you've really hit the nail on the head with that one, Tony, because that is something of a moot point. What happens with a lot of reports is that they disappear into what's called the grey literature. So we write the report, we give a copy to the local authority. So if somebody wants to see a copy, they can just go to the local authority and get it. There are some reports available on Know Your Place, but many reports are not available. In terms of the number of reports that are actually published, even a summary, it's a pretty small proportion of the work that is actually done. Now, the research archaeologists have been getting wise to this, and they've started to use the grey literature, what we call the grey literature, which is all of these unpublished reports coming out of developer projects, and they've been starting to use them for research purposes. And it's been a bit of a revelation in terms of the amount of work that is actually available.
Worth mentioning the Know Your Place website, which is www.kypwest.org.uk. That's kypwest.org.uk, where you can go and cycle back through your local area and find out what's known about previous. I mean, a lot of this is just simply, we're relying, aren't we, on, you know, medieval even map, people writing, doing maps in back hundreds of years.
Well, the earliest reliable maps for Bristol are probably the 18th century ones. There are earlier depictions. They tend to be a bit stylistic.
Yes, I imagine.
I mean, they're
they
beautiful. They're
They've got
beautiful
absolutely no
things.
Idea of proportion, potentially. You know, you might find, well, it's about right, but they haven't actually got the straight lines quite as straight.
Yeah. I mean, the first one that people tend to regard as useful in a general sense is by a guy called Millard. And you can go up to the museum and you can buy reproductions of his map. And it's a really beautiful thing. And of course, when he did that map in the latter part of the 17th century, Bristol still had its circuit of walls. And so you see the walls depicted, the various gates like Lawson's Gate, pulled down in the 18th century. It's a really, really lovely thing.
I've got to ask, what piqued your interest originally in archaeology? What stage did you think, gosh, this is really for me?
Well, I fell into archaeology. It rather found me rather than the other way around. I'm really a historical geographer. After I left uni, I did another job for absolutely ages. But the chance of doing a research degree at Bristol University came up. So I did that part-time. And I then got to nearing to complete it. So I decided to take a bit of a gamble and I walked out of my job that I'd been in for 11 and a half years, really quite well paid. I got redundancy. Luckily, we're going back to 2001 now, I managed to get a job in one of the local archaeological units on the basis of not much experience, I have to say. I don't have an archaeology degree, so I've kind of learned on the job.
But you got a geography degree, did you say?
My first degree was in history and geography.
So, I mean, what's the connection, do you think? What for you, is it, I mean, is archaeology taking that on a step?
Yeah, yes, indeed it is. And if that's why I say my interest is in landscape archaeology. And in fact, my research degree at Bristol was in early medieval landscape archaeology.
So when you say landscape archaeology, how does that differ from the stuff we've been talking about?
Oh, gosh. I mean, where do I start? It's basically looking at the kind of macro level. So you're looking at entire wide landscapes. I think what a lot of people don't appreciate is that if I were to hand you a Roman coin and ask you, is that an archaeological artifact? You would probably say yes. If I were to show you a picture from Google Earth of a typical piece of English countryside and say, and ask you the same question, is that an archaeological artefact? I wonder what your answer
would
be.
I would say no. I'd say it's a whole load of fields and some hedges.
Yeah, in fact, it is an archaeological artefact in exactly the same way as that Roman coin is. That landscape has been made by people, and that's the definition of an artefact. Over centuries, or in fact, even millennia, people have been making that landscape. It's an interesting fact, Tony, again, not widely appreciated, that there is no such thing as natural landscape in this country. There is not one blade of grass. There is not one square centimetre.
What about ancient woodland?
There is no... Well, there is a technical just definition of ancient woodland. There is no what we call wildwood, post-glacial wildwood left in the UK, so far as I'm aware. Probably you'll have experts calling in saying I'm talking rubbish, but it's all, for the most part, regenerated.
Okay, so we have been crawling over this country for thousands of years and affecting the way it looks.
Yes, either directly or indirectly, there isn't a square inch that is not in some way adapted or made or modified by human hand.
Well, what about Bristol itself, though? Because the city is, I think it's a bit like La Rochelle in France. It's a natural port with the gorge as it is. You know, that's a natural protection from the sea. And even the Bristol Channel, you could say, is a natural protection from the sea. And if anyone wants to invade you and do you in, they've got quite a series of defences to negotiate just to get to Bristol.
Yes, I mean, that's true. I'm
that's,
not
so there's that. A, but that, I suppose that's why we're here, isn't it? I mean, that's what certainly one of the things I assume is why Bristol is here is just because of the natural way that the rocks have formed and the terrain is here.
Yeah, the that's interesting. I mean, the very early origins of Bristol are really kind of lost in the mists of time. I mean, there's been a lot of there's a great report that's just been published at a place called Finsel's Reach, which is not very far from Bristol Bridge, and they've had some Anglo-Saxon stuff. We know that there was a largish trading settlement in Bristol by the late pre-conquest period, so the late Anglo-Saxon period. But its origins are a little bit vague, to be absolutely honest with you. I mean, again, people even are still, after all this time, arguing about the meaning of the place name. It seems to mean the place with the bridge, or the place where there is a bridge, or the place at the bridge. It would be interesting to see what Richard Coates says about it, actually.
Well, we go anywhere else, let's just see what he has to say about Bristol. Brigstow, isn't it?
There are numerous different versions.
Here we go. Bridge place from Old English bridge. Gathering place, especially one with religious significance, simply have meant the town which had grown up beside the bridge, the original Bristol Bridge.
Yeah, yeah. It's a crossing point, but still, I think there's a little bit of mystery about exactly why here. It seems to be a convenient crossing point of the Frome and the Avon. But it seems almost to appear from nowhere in the kind of late Anglo-Saxon period.
I mean, is it normal that as trade around the world by ship is picking up, that's going to be a place where if there's a bridge over the river? I mean, if people are going from South Wales and going round to the West Country, they're bound to be crossing that bridge quite a lot, aren't they?
Well, I don't think a date has been established for the first bridging point. And also, you know, there were more important trading places in the 7th century. I mean, if you'd gone back to the 7th century and stood roughly where Bristol Castle was, I mean, what would you have seen? I mean, the short answer is nobody knows. Bedminster was far more important at that date. Bedminster was a really, really, as I've said, it was a large royal manor. I don't think I'm incorrect to say that we really don't know what was going on.
I mean, for anybody interested in archaeology generally in the city, are there any particular places to go that you can find out more, like museums, that kind of thing?
Bristol Museum is really good. There are some really good books on Bristol archaeology. They tend to be collections of sites, to be honest, because what happens is if it's a developer-funded excavation, it gets written up as a site. I'm struggling, to be honest, to think of any book that brings together the archaeology of Bristol generally, except one book that was published a couple of years ago by Bob Jones and a couple of other authors. Now, Bob Jones was the city archaeologist. He's retired now, but he was city archaeologist for Bristol for the local authority for many years, and he knows the city's archaeology backwards. And what he has done is he's brought the archaeology together in this massive tome, which is kind of instantly become invaluable, but it's pretty expensive. But you can find it online.
So the title is Bristol, a Worshipful Town and Famous City, an Archaeological Assessment. And that is priced £36. The authors, Nigel Baker, Jonathan Brett and Robert Jones. Also, look, as a final question, Nick, isn't there like a world of difference between doing archaeology out in the countryside, like we see on Time Team, and doing the sort of urban stuff that you're doing?
Yeah, that's a really good point. There absolutely is. In the countryside, very often the depths tend to be rather shallower. You're generally not going down so deep. In urban environments, as we've talked about earlier, you tend to get quite deep. I think I mentioned the word stratigraphy, the layers basically that build up over time. They can be meters deep. Are you familiar with, did I hear you say you're a Londoner?
Yeah.
You know, Fleet Street, St. Bride's Church?
Oh, yeah.
Ever been to St. Bride's Church?
Yeah.
Have you been down into the basement?
Never.
Right. Down in the basement of St. Bride's Church in Fleet Street in London. I know we're supposed to be talking about Bristol, but it's just an example. Meters down, you can go down the steps into the basement and you're at street level in Roman times. It's like going into a time machine. You're instantly stepping back. You're walking on Roman surfaces. And in fact, there's a Roman townhouse down in the basement of St. Bride's Church. And in Bristol, you can get kinds of similar experience. Again, unbeknownst to most people, on the west, I think it's the western side of Castle Park, just opposite St. Nick's Church, where that horrible big old concrete bank used to be. Well, there used to be the Bank of England. Remember that,
building? Yeah.
Can you imagine in your mind's eye, you're looking at it and there's this concrete kind of pyramid, this tall concrete pyramid. Remember that? Okay, well, there's a door in it.
Yeah.
You can get special access to that door, and that door will lead you down into the most stunning medieval vaulted room. It's actually probably a cellar of a medieval building, and it's just amazing. But you can only... And it was probably under a house, just on the other side of Bristol Bridge.
And this would have been built after the castle demolished the house?
No, it's medieval.
Wow.
So it's... I don't know the date, again, embarrassingly, but I've had the privilege of going down there. It was many years ago. But there is actually a door in that little concrete pyramid, and that's why that pyramid is there, to give access down into that vault. And there would have been a house on top of it, and... could have been a wine cellar for storing stuff or something like that.
Because this is one of the things people don't necessarily realise about Castle Park, is that originally, after the castle was demolished, which was a few years after the Civil War, that it was just built on kind of shopping centre, shopping area.
Yeah, and houses as well. There are houses there. And again, if you look at the early maps, which are available on Know Your Place, it was really, really densely occupied. Yeah, it's a great piece of Bristol.
KYPwest.org.uk. Anyway, Nick Corkos, been fascinating, and I think maybe we'll have to go and have a look under the pyramid on Castle Park one of these days.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it or listen to it on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees or subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you'd like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Nick Korkos, and to studio engineer, Dave Bozanko. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through People's Republic of Stoatscroft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us, or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain, via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Ella Mapes, wishing you a very good week. Tony will be back on Friday with his two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 to 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Touch is gonna make it through.